We're using the New International Version. Jenny has copies of the reading that will follow right along with what I'm reading from the New International Version, which is what our confirmands are using. And they are, as always, our special guest here. We're happy to see them. And we'll see how happy they are to see me tonight, because one of the things I want to do is to put them on the spot. Mrs. O doesn't know about this. They don't know about this. It's total pop quiz time for the confirmands. You'll see why in a moment. Sophie, you've got the hand mic ready to go, because we're going to have a pop quiz on the passage we're about to look at, precisely because if you attend both Sundays and Wednesdays, the passage we're about to look at is the passage we looked at 2.5 weeks ago on a Sunday, except it was from Luke. And being from Luke, Luke has a certain story he'd like to tell. Matthew, when he gives us the same story, is going to tell it differently, and he's going to frame it differently. And this is the beauty of reading straight through a gospel. We'll find that even though we've read these stories before and we're familiar with some of the aspects of them, that we're going to find that Matthew wants to take us in a whole different direction than Luke did with the same story. So we get to see how a gospel shapes the stories as they follow one episode into another. Even the fact that we know last week we're picking up immediately after Jesus has given us that wonderful promise. It's at the end of chapter 11, verse 28, right before we get into chapter 12. Come unto me, all that are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. You'll find rest for your souls. We finished with that last week. Learn of me. And we're going to learn of Jesus and what it means to be gentle and humble of soul, particularly when one is engaged in a controversy, in debate, in having to defend yourself. And we'll see how all of this is framed by this wonderful emphasis on gentleness and a focus on what really matters, that being the mercy of God. So keep this in mind. We talked about the yoke last week, that device that was meant to allow two beasts of burden to share the load. And essentially Jesus says to us that I'll yoke with you, I'll walk beside you, I'll help you carry your load. You will be with me, I will be with you. I won't drag you along, I won't manipulate you or force you, but I'll be there beside you, traveling with you, helping you throughout your journey. So we won't forget that Matthew left us there, because just like any good serial show where you see what happened previously and you know that whatever's happening in this episode is connected to the last episode, that's true of this controversy we're about to see that we looked at from Luke 2.5 weeks ago as Jesus' disciples are gleaning in the field. So this will sound a little bit familiar, and that's where I'd like to see how well you all are listening, but particularly how well the confirmands, because they get first dibs at these questions. Don't feel pressure. Even if you get it wrong, I'm glad you're here. Even if you get it wrong, you took a stab at it, and I'd rather have you take a stab and get it wrong than be completely silent and not, you know, offer anything at all. So I'm as lax as you can get. It's pretty easy to get an A from me, all right? So don't be too disturbed by this, confirmands. And if they can't come up with the answer to some of these questions, then we'll open it up to the rest of our congregation, and we will then be helping them out. And that's a good Christian thing to do as well. So here's our disciples, Matthew chapter 12, verse 1. We're going to go through verse 21 tonight. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to Jesus, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." So here's the question, confirmands. Why were the Pharisees upset by Jesus and his disciples? Why were they upset? Who wants to get it over with and take the first stab? Our confirmands, some are back there. I think a few are scattered. Why were the Pharisees up? These are not trick questions, by the way. Why were the Pharisees upset by Jesus and his disciples? Who wants to take the first stab? You're not a confirmand. You're not a confirmand. You're past confirmand, so good for you. Trained to take a step. You want to try, Kaylin? Yes? No? No. Okay. Sister just volunteered you. And yeah, okay. Confirmands. Mrs. O, who do you want to pick?
Claire.
Claire. You know it. All right, so pass that down very quickly to Claire. I'm not looking for a sermon. Just a quick answer. Do you remember from 2.5 weeks ago why they were so upset? Speak up once again. Okay, what law? What law? The Sabbath law. And the Sabbath law forbade doing what on the seventh day? I'm sticking with you, Claire. And then you'll be done. Then you'll be done. You won't have to worry. You go, shh, I'm done. Yeah, that's the answer. Whatever she's talking about. Work. Work of any kind. And so what are the disciples doing that the Pharisees consider work? They're picking grain. They're harvesting, right? You got it. Okay, you're covered. Claire's done. Good job, Claire. The Pharisees were committed to the law. The law said on the Sabbath, it's a day holy unto God, 6 days you work, one day you rest, which means you don't do the work that you do on the 6 days on that day of rest. And because they had to really wrestle with what that meant, they had a number of things that they thought you couldn't do. One of the things that you clearly couldn't do, and in fact the Torah, the Pentateuch, the law of Moses, said you couldn't do, was to harvest on the Sabbath. So as they're picking the grain, the Pharisees see them as harvesting. Then when they tear the chaff from the wheat, they're seen as threshing. And then when they eat, they're seen as preparing a meal, breaking at least three conventional ideas of what you couldn't do on the Sabbath. Now, there's nothing sinful about picking grain or threshing it or preparing a meal, right? It's not that they were doing anything wrong, it's just they were doing it the wrong time. That's what Sabbath is always about. Things that are forbidden on Sabbath aren't bad things. They're things you can do any other time, but they're not bad things in and of themselves. It's just when you do it that's wrong, and that's what the Pharisees have a beef about. Do most of you remember that from 2.5 weeks ago? You hopefully do. This is also a check to see how well the congregation is listening to some of these things, and I know they do. I know you do. You give me great attention. I appreciate it. So here's the second question. Did the Pharisees have good reasons to be upset? Looking for another confirm man. Did the Pharisees have good reasons to be upset? Right here. Evan. Evan got volunteered by Grandma. Evan, did they have good reasons to be upset?
Yes.
What were their good what was one good reason?
Because they were breaking the Sabbath law.
Okay. And were the Pharisees troubled by it because they were just mean, grumpy old men who liked to make people's lives bad?
No.
Not at all, right? They were troubled because setting apart the Sabbath was sacred, holy. It developed the faith of the people. It made their commitment to God that much more enriched. And they were concerned. If you started breaking laws on the Sabbath and taught your disciples to do it and did it publicly, that meant that perhaps the whole day would collapse and people would not grow in faith. They wouldn't love God. They wouldn't worship God. So thank you, Evan. Good answer. And that's important to remember because you will hear some preaching that will talk about the Pharisees as if they are demonic figures ready to burst from their human skin with horns and teeth glaring, ready to just make a mess for everybody. These are devout people. These are people you'd want on your leadership team. These are people you'd want leading the show. These are people you'd want in charge of a church or a synagogue. They're devout, they're holy, they're concerned about matters of the law. They're careful to keep them. They pray, they fast, they read their scriptures, they memorize their scriptures. They are holy folk. They are not bad people. They just see this as something that is so troubling to their current tradition. Because in Jesus' mind, it's something new, and we know it's something new. But for them, it's something that's a threat. And so, they have good reasons. They are not just petty legalists. They're concerned that the life of faith be guarded. so that people learn and grow in faith. So, that covers what we looked at 2.5 weeks ago. And then there's one other thing we did 2.5 weeks ago that our text does, and it's Jesus' defense. But what Matthew does different than Luke, Luke gave one defense. Actually, about two. Matthew gives five. Because Matthew wants to present Jesus, who is a master debater. He can out-argue anyone. So if you want to tangle with Jesus, you do notice in the scriptures, he never loses a single debate he ever enters into. He always finds a way to turn the tables back on his opponent or to make his opponent have to second guess why they even asked the question in the first place. He is a master at this. If he wanted to, he could get up on a debate stage when it came to religion, the law, the faithful tradition, and outdo everybody. And so now we're going to get five arguments where he just completely slice against the Pharisees' reaction. The first one we're familiar with because Luke actually used it. Verse 3, he answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priest." Do you remember that? Couple weeks ago. His point is, hundreds of years ago, King David, on the run from Saul, had hungry men. He was threatened by Saul with his very life. He came to the tabernacle at the time. There was no bread for his hungry men to eat. And so he pled with the high priest, "Let us have the holy bread." The high priest said, "You know, that's holy bread just for the priest. It's not for a parishioner." And David says, "You got to let me have it." And the priest, because David is David, gave him the bread. His men ate it. And Jesus is essentially saying, you know, if that's good enough for David, why isn't it good enough for the son of David? Now, the Pharisees don't see Jesus in that exalted sense. But in Jesus' mind, he is the son of David. He is the one greater than David even. And so if David has done it, there's a certain precedent that's already been set. But then he moves to some other arguments. Beginning at verse 5. These weren't used in Luke. "Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priest in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent?" Those are tough words, but they're true words. And the people of Israel knew that the priest, when they circumcised, when they cut the meat, when they made the offerings, were working. In fact, it was their very work to do that work on the Sabbath. And so they got a free pass. People knew that they were working, but because they're doing the so-called work of God, they got a pass. And Jesus says, you know, if the priests aren't subject to the Sabbath requirements, like the people are, why couldn't it be possible that perhaps others may not be subject to those same Sabbath requirements? To which the Pharisees might answer, well, your disciples aren't priests. And then Jesus offers what's perhaps the most shocking statement in this defense. Verse 6, "I tell you that one greater than the temple is here." There is no more significant religious symbol and experience for the people of Israel than the temple. That is the meeting place between heaven and earth. It is the microcosm that represents God's sovereignty over all. It is the holy place that houses the holy of holies, the very throne room of God. And for Jesus to say, something greater is here, is fighting words. I mean, he's really, really saying something about his sense of himself, his ministry, who he is, and indeed, what newness he brings. That whatever he's bringing into being is something that surpasses even the holiness and the importance of the temple. He's not undermining the temple. He's simply saying something greater than the temple is here. Matthew loves to do this. Something greater than Solomon is here. Something greater than the temple is here. He has about three or four others. Something greater than Jonah is here, he'll say before this chapter is out. So he likes to do that, that something new is breaking in with Jesus' gospel, that the kingdom of heaven is at hand, which is so new and so fresh, you can't put it in old wineskins. It's new wine. And it's breaking in, and Jesus says words that I guarantee, if we were there, we'd hear the Pharisees go, Because that's, you know, that's deep, heavy words that undermines everything that they hold dear. Then he moves to the very heart of his defense. He said all this because previously in about chapter 6, he'd asked the Pharisees when they had their first spat, "I need you to go back and read Hosea. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." So we need to remember that that happened in Matthew earlier. So now he says, verse 7, "If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,'" quoting the prophet Isaiah, "you would not have condemned the innocent." I desire mercy, not sacrifice. You wouldn't have condemned the innocent, that is my disciples plucking the grain, if you had understood that what God's law is always about in all its forms is the showing of mercy. That mercy trumps sacrifice. Mercy trumps law. Mercy is the reason for the law because the heart of God who gave it is, "I am the Lord God, merciful and compassionate." That mercy must be the priority. For the preeminent expression of God's will in all its forms, which all the laws are different ways to implement the law, God's will in our lives, is that mercy is to trump all. So if they'd known the letter, if they'd known the heart of the lawgiver rather than the letter of the law, they wouldn't have condemned the innocent. But as it is, they've disregarded mercy for the sake of keeping the rules. And so Jesus says, you have no mercy. And that's what the law is supposed to be about. One of the reasons the high priest could give David and his men the bread when they were on the run is he felt mercy for them. That they needed this sustenance or they may have not got any farther. And then finally he ends with the one other thing he does say in Luke. "For the Son of Man," verse 8, "is Lord of the Sabbath." Which is a way to say he, as he refers himself to the Son of Man, it's his favorite self talk. When he says that, he's saying that he has the rights and the obligations to determine what is right and what is wrong on the Sabbath. Because David, being the king who is held up as the Messiah figure, has given birth through generations to the son of David, who has come to be Messiah, to bring in God's new covenant, to bring in God's new kingdom and new way. So he's showing the authority he has there. And that's where that story ends and then moves into the withered hand story, which Luke also makes those stories follow one another. The one thing that's important to notice is Jesus completely outdebates the Pharisees here, is he knows what they hold as an authority, the scriptures. The Hebrew way of understanding the scriptures is the law, the writings, and the prophets. There are three categories. The law, which is our Pentateuch, the writings, which are the historical books, and the prophets, which are all of the prophets, major and minor, that we've looked at. Do you notice he's referred to every one? The writings, the historical books with the precedent of David, the law with his speaking about the temple, and the prophets with the priority of mercy. He's taken everything they hold dear, and he said, "I'll take into account all it is that you embrace as authoritative, and I'll show you how in every category of God's word, law, writings, and prophets, that God's mercy is preeminent, and what you're advocating is wrong." And so that's the first half of our story. That takes us into the synagogue. And in the synagogue, things get a little bit more heated. We looked at this story 2.5 weeks ago as well. This is how Luke goes. Verse 9, "Going on from that place, he went into their synagogue. And a man with a shriveled hand was there." His hand was withered or atrophied. And it's a, I don't think he says it's a right hand here. So he doesn't actually emphasize like Luke does that it's his working hand, his right hand in ancient culture. Looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" You remember Luke? Luke, Jesus asks them. So in Luke's gospel, Jesus is the one asking the questions and he feels like he needs to do something. But now the stage is set and they ask him the question, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" Well, here in Matthew, he gives a different defense than he does in Luke. It's a very practical defense. It's almost so watertight you can't argue against it. And so he says, verse 11, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out?" He speaks about a poor man that perhaps just has one sheep, because he doesn't talk about a sheepfold. It's someone who just literally their whole livelihood depends on the life of this sheep and how they make their living off this sheep. And if you have a sheep and they get into a dangerous position and they cannot wait and they're in dire circumstances, you're going to, and they all would have to nod yes. We'd all think that the right thing to do was to lift it out of its misery and out of its danger and do something to help it. And then he says, verse 12, how much more valuable is a man than a sheep? You're treating your sheep better than a person. Or as some folk in our society, you're treating your pet better than you do other people. You're giving them more slack than you'd ever give a real flesh and blood person. So, therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. It is lawful to do good. And what's one of the things doing good? To heal this poor man whose arm is atrophied. It's good if you would deliver the sheep. Why wouldn't you do it for someone who's in need that you can help on that very day? Wouldn't that be an expression of sanctity and holiness and lawful goodness? That's what he's trying to get at here. And so he just flat out does what Jesus does. Verse 13, then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Do you remember the irony I tried to underline when we did this 2.5 weeks ago? The irony that Jesus doesn't break the law. He's not doing work. He simply speaks a word, and a word can never be work. Stretch out your hand. But the Pharisees plot and scheme and plan and prepare to do something to out Jesus. And in doing that, they end up, ironically, doing work on the Sabbath. And so we have a very interesting set of stories. But the thing I think Matthew wants to highlight, and I hope you notice this in Matthew, is Matthew wants to show you how great a debater is Jesus. How in controversies, he's not at the whims of others. He's the one that's basically making it all happen. He's the one guiding where the discussion is going. He's able to out-debate and outwit anyone that would like to take him on. And Matthew wants us to see that if Jesus wanted to spend all of his ministry undermining the false leaders or the bad leaders or the legalists or people who were troublesome, he could do it. If he wanted to spend all of his time engaged in controversies, he could probably make a name for himself as someone that constantly outwits everyone. A master rhetorician. But instead, that's not why he came. He does this. Verse 15. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. Many followed him, and he healed all their sick, warning them not to tell who he was. This was to fulfill, and Matthew loves that word, this was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. And now, at the end of our reading, we get the longest fulfillment passage in the whole book of Matthew. This is the longest quote Matthew will give. He wants us to see how important it is that we understand that what he's about to say about Jesus is at the very heart of Jesus' ministry. He's quoting from Isaiah 42, which is one of the handful of passages that are called suffering servant passages. It's the passage where this suffering servant, this true Israelite, is doing the work and the will of God, and God is pleased by what this one does. But in doing the will of God, this suffering servant is broken and beaten and whipped and rejected and all of those things which we've come to associate with Jesus. So he quotes the fulfillment, and here it is. "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight." Does that sound reminiscent of anything? "This is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased." That's baptism language when Jesus is baptized, but prior to that, it's Isaiah's language of the suffering servant. "This is my beloved, in whom I'm well pleased. I'll put my spirit on him." What happens at the baptism? The Spirit descends and it fills Jesus and he moves into his ministry. He will proclaim justice to the nations. Okay, we've seen this. He can proclaim it. He can preach it. He can debate it. But here's the important thing. He will not quarrel or cry out. He's not going to make a big deal of himself. That's the idea. Someone who cries out at the corner and they're drawing all the attention to themselves. Think politics if you'd like. It's that idea. Will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets because he's not out to be a famed person that everyone is drawn to because he's this master rhetorician. A bruised reed, verse 20, he will not break. And a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In other words, what's important to him is what's really usually very unimportant to people who are in power. To people who truly do have that skill of speaking. The people that he's concerned about aren't the ones that he can out-debate with his intellect. They are the ones that perhaps could care less about his intellect, but need to know that their lives, though broken and hanging by a thread, matter. And he won't break them, he won't snuff them out till he leads justice to victory, and in his name the nations will hope. You get a picture of Jesus. It is very much like that song we sing, the God of the humble, the friend of the weak. You get one who is not going to shout to get his voice heard or push others out of his way to get ahead, and certainly not push down on the weak and the feeble to get above. He's humble, he's gentle, he's ideal. He will preserve the broken reed rather than get rid of it. He will fan into flame the smoldering wick even though it's dying out. And you just can't get a more beautiful picture of Jesus' love and care, which is then to say God's love and care for the weak, the broken, the hurting, the dying, the gasping, the people just hanging by a thread. That what Jesus has come for is not to be a master politician. Because had he wanted to do that, he could have out-debated them all. He has come not to show power in a way that is careless about those who often suffer as the powerful among us banter back and forth and do their thing. He has come to show love to the weak. And now you see how this connects to, come unto me, all that are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Learn of me. And we've just learned of it. We've just seen. I praise you, Lord, that you've not shown yourself to the wise and intelligent, but to the children. And we begin to see that Jesus' interest in his ministry are far different than perhaps sometimes our own interests are in a world that worships power and that worships intelligence and worships the ability to outmaneuver someone through debate. That it's a much different calling he has, and he refuses to get caught up in the controversy when there's mercy to be shown. That leads me then to these two reflections. We see in these stories the preeminence of mercy, and I think if the Pharisees warn us about anything, because we never are going to demonize them, they are good people, what they warn us of is it's possible to be committed to holy living and to doctrinal precision and to spiritual disciplines like fasting and praying and Bible reading and knowing our scriptures as best we can, and still absolutely miss what matters. It completely miss the point. Completely not find the heart. It's possible. And nobody needs that warning more than those of us who sit in the seats of the Pharisees, those of us who are concerned about the faith and its tradition and its preservation and its passing on, and it's being held in such high esteem that we are very careful about modifying or changing any of it. It's important for us to realize that the Pharisees are us, and that we must make sure that we don't make their mistake. Their mistake wasn't that they didn't know the scriptures, they knew them. Their mistake was in the interpretation of it. Mercy wasn't preeminent. Mercy was optional. Keeping the rules was preeminent. Mercy was just, you know, if possible, you throw a little in. For Jesus, mercy's what matters most. And if the rules get in the way, push the rules aside. Because mercy will have the preeminence. The reason he will do this is because of passages like Hosea, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Passages like Micah, God delights to show mercy. And perhaps the most important one, which I've referred to time and again tonight, when God reveals God's self to Moses, I am Yahweh, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. We must never forget that this is the preeminent characteristic of our God, this chesed, this faithful covenant loyalty, that God is out to show mercy to all. And our faith is meant to make us learn of me. I'm gentle and humble in heart, more merciful to others. And perhaps where many of us need to start isn't showing mercy to the one person we tend to show the least mercy to, some of us, ourselves. Can't tell you how many beloved saints and parishioners I know that are so much more compassionate to others than they will be to themselves, in the sense of a failing or a hurt or a brokenness or a difficulty they're going through. And I think, you know, if you were counseling another person, you'd be so much more merciful and compassionate because that's how you are. But when it comes to ourselves, we stop that and we forget. And the reason why I think that's the hardest is we must constantly keep in mind the God that we love, the God that we serve, is the God that desires mercy, not sacrifice. The God whose first attribute highlighted is I'm merciful. Don't forget that. Tender, kind, gentle, forgiving, loving. That's always at the top. And that then leads me to the only other point I want to reflect on tonight, that I find it so interesting that Jesus chooses mercy over controversy. He could spend his whole ministry proving he's right, and he'd do it. He could out-debate, he could out-argue any of the opposition, but instead he chooses to focus on the primacy of mercy shown particularly to those who are least likely to be amazed at his sharp intellect or his keen wit or his ability to out-debate or out-argue. That's the yoke that Jesus invites us to, that gentleness, that mercifulness, that humility. And I want to leave with one quote because I think Stanley Sanders in his book highlights how this really is the yoke. Take my yoke upon you, learn of me. How do you learn of him? Well, we read through the rest of Matthew and then we come to this fulfillment passage which highlights once again the mercy, the care, the tenderness to the smoldering wick, and we realize that's the yoke. That's the yoke we're invited to take. So Stanley puts this all together in this quote and we're done. He says, Jesus' ministry is an excellent paradigm for Christian ministry. Jesus calls for and embodies both mercy and healing. Modern people often draw a sense of purpose and identity from the conflicts in which they engage. That's understating the point. I mean, watch news. It's just all about conflict. We're not about information anymore. It's really all about where's the biggest fight? The battle, the fight. I mean, that's what we're about. This big conflict. That's where we draw interest and purpose and identity. You know, the labels we put on ourselves. I'm this and you're that and you're wrong and I'm right and you're bad and I'm good. Jesus too is engaged in conflict, one that will lead to his death, but he's careful to keep his focus on his ministry of healing and restoration. He is not defined by the conflict his ministry generates, but by his obedience to God's call and will. He is the servant. Amidst the many conflicts that dominate American political and religious life, it is important for us to remember that we are, above all else, servants of the Lord of the Sabbath, who does not break a bruised reed or extinguish a flickering flame. We must keep that as a priority. We're not better Christians because we fight for our beliefs or we take a stand for our political ideals. We're better Christians when we show mercy to all, even those who want to put up a fight. Jesus could put up a defense all he wants, but he withdraws to do the real work to show mercy to those who are broken and beaten, and in that culture's mindset, relatively worthless to his cause, and yet they are the focus. May that be true for us as well. Will you pray with me before we receive our prayers?